Okay. So, any questions about anything astrophysics related or unrelated? Where did it? Okay. Well, I'm heading to UW afterwards for the colloquium. So if you want to ask it, you have to ask now or forever hold your silence. But until tomorrow, probably. We can, of course, discuss it tomorrow as well. You're gonna have to, but I mean, as you by now you've guessed that the rules of this course are a little bit soft, it seems. So I mean, the whole point of having tutorials is to have time to discuss things. So, but anyway, I mean, you're welcome to ask questions if you want, right? So, what is the question? Is it how to solve it? Is that the question?
No, actually, I tried to solve the second question for the Foucault gaps, which was like to calculate the Hamiltonian perturbation, but
Right.
it was extremely complicated because like for calculating the G theta, it's the Hamiltonian is dependent on theta, so
Even for circular orbits, I thought that.
yes, because it appears in the radius between the asteroid and Jupiter that there's a dependence on theta. So
Hey.
in that case, if we're gonna try to calculate G R and G theta, the G theta is not gonna be simple as calculating the non-primitive Hamiltonian, which makes it like really messy.
Yeah, I don't think it should be messy. I think for circular orbit, it should be very straightforward. I'm not 100%, what is it that you're
So
saying?
circular orbit of Jupiter, right?
Jupiter is circular, but so is the
The
asteroid.
asteroid.
Asteroid is also circular.
Even though you consider it circular, you still have for the G theta calculation, the Hamiltonian depends on theta, so you cannot consider P theta as equal to the derivative of the Lagrangian.
Okay, so let's then discuss this tomorrow then, because it seems that
It just cares about its relative angle. Between the
right.
two, because that will determine distance between the asteroid
Right. There might be some subtleties there, but whatever it is, it should become simple close to circular orbit, because everything is analytic for a single circular orbit. I mean, even for elliptical orbit, everything is analytic, but this is much more, it's more analytic for a circular orbit. Okay. But we can discuss this in more detail tomorrow. Good. So we've started talking about plasmas. We introduced two basic notions in plasma. There were plasma frequencies and plasma frequency and plasma energy bilengths. So there was plasma frequency. The bilength. And these are basically the characteristic time scale and length scales for neutrality in a plasma. Basically, they both have to do with what electrons do. This is basically how electrons distribute around charged objects to neutralize it. This is the depth that electric field basically can penetrate a plasma. And this was the time scale it takes for an electric field to decay or to oscillate, which eventually leads to its decay. So I'm not going to repeat the formulas. But basically, what it did was so this omega p, this was something as proportional to density. Omega p squared is 4 pi e squared n divided by mass of electron and the bilength. Well, it depends on temperature. It's to do where did I put it? It's kt divided by 4 pi n bar or n e squared. So And these are all, so omega p is something about their radio frequency, kilohertz or so. So what it implies is that, as I said, it gives a mass for photon, and we're going to, either today or next week, we're going to drive it in more detail. So when we say photon is a massless, that's a statement for vacuum. If you have a plasma of certain density, ionized plasma of certain density, then this actually is the mass of the photon. And you cannot get, basically, frequencies below this cannot propagate in your medium. So for example, this is why we can hear radio in from far distances, because radio waves that are transmitted by radio stations, they actually hit the ionosphere, which is ionized, and they get reflected because their frequency is lower than the plasma frequency of the ionosphere. The higher frequencies, they can actually penetrate the ionosphere. And so that's about, this is of order of a few kilohertz. I guess for ionosphere, I'm not 100% sure, it depends on the density. What is the frequency of radios? Does anybody know? I think it's megahertz or something. Yeah, so that depends on the density of the ionosphere. So this is of order kilohertz for an interstellar medium. For, of course, for a density of ionosphere, it would be higher. I don't have the number off the top of my head. The debye length is also tiny. So for large, for high energy photons, this is irrelevant. Like for optical photons, this is irrelevant. For radio waves, it's important. And the debye length is also tiny if almost for all astrophysical situations. This is much smaller. So that means that you're dealing with neutral plasmas.
So you said the frequency of plasma is the other
kilohertz? Right. So for so this is of order omega plasma is of order or divided by 2 pi. This gives you the linear frequency. So usually when people quote frequency, like frequency on the radio, it's linear frequency, which is omega divided by 2 pi. And that's 9 kilohertz times n divided by 1 per square centimeter. So the 1/2. So for interstellar medium, it's that this value, like for solar system, it would be bigger for ionosphere because, of course, the density is bigger. Right. But this is a thing for ionosphere. I have it somewhere in notes, I think, early in the course. It's somewhere around some megahertz, I believe. So it should be bigger than the like the radio that you hear on. I don't know if there's anybody else it still uses the radio.
But you say radio cannot penetrate.
Exactly, yeah. That if the frequency is less than this, it cannot penetrate. Because the minimum frequency a photon has is this, the photon that can propagate. So photon with less frequency than a small frequency than this cannot penetrate. It would be just reflected like a mirror.
And where are we expected to find this plasma?
Everywhere. So ionosphere, the idea is that so you have Earth atmosphere, and so how does this work exactly? So there, for some reason, the upper atmosphere of Earth is ionized. I'm trying to remember. Is it because of the UV radiation from the sun? I think it's absorbed by the ozone molecules, and then the ionized. So I don't know this. I guess maybe I knew this. Maybe if I teach it, that's taught it at some point, but I've forgotten. But for some reason, there is an upper atmosphere of Earth which is ionized. It's either because of the solar wind or it's because of the UV radiation from the sun. That's 100% sure. But CMB is a higher frequency. So CMB is higher frequency than the radios. So CMB is something like 100 gigahertz.
Wow.
Right. So the radio that you hear, like you get your TV, or I guess we used to get, well, I guess some we still get, there is still TV, you have to get an antenna or radio that you hear, I mean, on your car, they are much less, a much smaller frequency.
Like high frequency radio in your car, like dial on FM goes up to like 150 megahertz?
150 megahertz, okay, right. So that's still like one order of, what is it, no, three orders of magnitude, right? 100.
So when people talk about the original TV signals would penetrate the atmosphere. Why is that?
Okay, so that would be, then there would be a range, right? So I think that TV signals are higher frequency. And I don't have it, so you should, this depends on the density of the ionosphere. I think it's, if you have Padmanabhan's book, it's somewhere in the first chapter, it says what it is. I don't have it. And it is in my notes, if you could look like in the first or second lecture. I have that as well. Right, so there is indeed a threshold above which you can, the signals go out, they penetrate, they get out of the atmosphere. Below that, it would be reflected, so you can get it, receive it from far away, basically. Okay, good. So, and I guess the key, one key thing is that you have this omega p times lambda d is of order v thermal, which is kT divided by the mass of electron. And so basically there is a so-called de Bias sphere, if you will. Which the size of it is de Bias length. And the time that it takes for a particle, for an electron to cross it, is the time is 1/Planck, 1/. So it's the thermal electron, the time it takes to cross it is 1/ plasma frequency. And as we discussed, an ideal plasma is one that has lots of electrons in here. Okay, so you need a lot of electrons in here.
This is.
You're saying, sorry, when is it not an ideal plasma?
Low electron density.
Right, so the lambda d, I didn't write the number, but it's something like 7 cm. So it's not actually that hard. Where did I put it? It's 7 cm.
It's 7 cm times the square root of t over n, where t is in Kelvin.
A square root of t over, and then there's n to the minus 1 in a square root. So
it's n to the minus 1 half.
N to the minus 1 half?
That's what
I do have that, right? So did I mistype to something here? Right. No, this is lambda d squared. Sorry, that's what I'm saying. So you're right. OK, good. So. So you can see for T of a Kelvin and number densities of order 1 per square centimeter, this is of order 7 cm. So in fact, it's not terribly big, right, compared to a centimeter. Because of, if number density is 1/√cm², then you have, I guess, 7³ within a de Bias sphere. But of course, at temperature of a Kelvin, it's not a plasma. Right? So if you want to have plasma, it's usually, it must be hotter than 10⁴ Kelvin so that you can ionize. Remember, 10⁴ Kelvin is 1 eV, and ionization energy for hydrogen is 13 eV. Right? So if you go to higher temperature, this gets bigger. Right? So then you have an ideal plasma. So it's not something that's, it's not huge, it's the not a huge number, but what happens is that if you have a hot enough plasma, and that's the key thing, it must be a hot enough plasma, and you see, this is the key thing, right? So the thermal energy must be much bigger than the electrostatic energy of neighboring particles. So in a sense, this is the definition of plasma. I'm not sure whether that's an exact statement, but I think in some sense, it's the definition of plasma. Because if thermal energy is less than the electrostatic energy, then you find you form basically bound atoms, right? Because thermal energy is not enough to ionize the atom. So this having an ideal plasma basically means that your thermal energy is far above the temperature to ionize atoms into electron ions, right? Okay, good questions. Other questions? Okay, so now that we talked about so this basic concept, so I'm going to talk about so the plan. Let's see how far we can get. I'm going to talk about collisional effects in plasma, and this is going to be basically very, very similar to collisional effects in gravity, except that, instead of G, I have E squared, because you have, instead of gravitational force, you have Coulomb law. And then I want to talk about linear modes, linear perturbations on plasma, which is essentially a more sophisticated way of the way I derive plasma frequency. But just instead of starting from Newton's second law, the way I did it before, I'm going to start from Boltzmann equation. So those are the plans. So first, talk about collisions, and then talk about linear perturbations. Okay. But let's just start with collisions. So remember our friend.
Yeah.
Yes.
Before you continue, I'm
sure.
A bit lost. So CMB electron has temperature of 3 Kelvin.
CMB photon has temperature of 3 Kelvin, right?
That's, if you want to expect the frequency, oh, you expect lambda to be very big.
Right. Lambda is. Gosh, it's about a millimeter or micron to millimeter. Well, it's no, sorry, it's not micron, it's millimeter. I mean, we can calculate this, right? So I said temperature is 1 Kelvin, right? 3 Kelvin, I guess, per CMB photon. And so how do you calculate the wavelength? So wavelength is, let's say energy is h nu is kT. So this is for CMB, right? And then lambda times nu is the speed of light, right? So the basic stuff. So lambda is c divided by nu, and nu is kT divided by h, so it's c divided by kT times h, right? Right. Okay, so what are these numbers? So I want to estimate this. C is 10 to the 10 in CGS units. I said 3 times 10 to the 10. Planck constant is what? 10 to the minus? Anyone? That's one number I don't remember. I think it's 10 to the minus 27. Is that right? OK, 10 to the minus 27. Let's say Boltzmann constant, 10 to the minus 16. Is that right? Okay, I actually have all of these. So you should always have one of these somewhere close by. Okay, good. So h is 10 to the minus 27. There's a 6 here. K is 10 to the minus 16, roughly 10 to the minus 16. And T is 3 Kelvin, right? So we get 10 with these guys. That's 11. 11 minus 27 is minus 16. And minus 16, so this is convenient, but this is roughly a centimeter. So that's the wavelength. Right. One third of a centimeter, yeah. We have millimeter, centimeter, right, I guess.
So if you actually put, I guess, the coefficient around 10 to the minus 16, you probably get down to
Yeah, let's see, h is 6 times, right, so you have 6 here, I guess there is a 1.6 there, I mean, this is of order of a centimeter, so I wasn't being very exact, millimeter, centimeter. Okay, of course, you can calculate this exactly, and the other point is, of course, this is the peak frequency or peak wavelength, it's a thermal spectrum, right, so there would be a range. I think depending on how you define the peak, there could be factors of order unity that appears. Yeah.
So the sign of Sandowich effect doesn't change it for value frequency?
Yeah, so that's less than this frequency. So the frequency you can calculate is going to be about of order 100 gigahertz. Nu you get is roughly 100 gigahertz. I think for certain Sanyaev Zalovich below 220 gigahertz is negative, above is positive. Good. So this is the scale. So and this is of course much bigger than the plasma frequency we've got here.
So if we were looking at CMB through the atmosphere, we'd expect some like hard cutoff at some point in the thermal distribution.
I would call it a soft cutoff, but yeah. It's at low frequencies it would be cut off. Right. Right, I think that's true. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Well, even then, at low frequencies, since you're not only getting cut off, but you're also having to deal with
interference from terrestrial radio.
Right, that would be the bigger problem. So there's somewhere in megahertz when you get, so that's kind of where radio frequency, somewhere around, I think megahertz is where basically radio observations stop. You cannot go below that. Or hundreds of, I think actually 100 megahertz, right?
I suppose, yeah, that is beneficial. Then you pick up, you know, the radio station.
Right, exactly. Yep, yeah.
So when we do radio, like observations.
Right.
Like with ground-based telescopes, how are we getting, like how are we expecting a what signal to noise?
Well, it should be bigger than that frequency, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So the what we call radio observations, the field of radio astronomy, somewhere between this frequency and this frequency. Right. So it's below CMB. Above it, you call it infrared, basically, or microwave or infrared. And below it, you call it So below this is radio astronomy. And then it stops somewhere around the megahertz. I mean, this is, of course, the very absolute lower limit. But the ionosphere is really the thing that puts the cutoff. I think it's 100 megahertz. I should remember this. But I don't. But I think maybe 10 to 100 megahertz is where the cutoff is. OK, good. So let's talk about our old friend, Boltzmann equation. So we're going to try to basically do this plasma physics basically systematically, same way that we did fluids. And of course, what we've learned is that the way to do things more systematically is to talk about the phase space. And then there's a force. I'm going to talk more about the force in a minute. So this is the Boltzmann equation. This is what you have to solve for plasma. Now what you notice is that there is an index A here. And the reason is that instead of having one type of particle, you have, by definition in a plasma, you have more than one type of particle. You have positive charge and negative charge. I guess you, even in the neutral fluid also, you could have multiple types of particles, but you don't have to. In the plasmas, that's guaranteed. And the type of forces, the larger scale forces that you see, depends on the type of particle that you have. Because this force depends on the charge. This goes as Q times E plus B cross B. And of course, this has different signs for electrons and ions. And there would be one, I guess this is not on a small scale, this is all that matters for the force. But then, of course, you have the gravitational force as well. Right? So this would be the gravitational force.
And we don't consider collisions between particle A and particle B?
No, they all go in here, right?
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, they all go in here. So this depends on all Fs, not just FA.
I see.
Right, exactly.
So they're going to be coupled equations.
Exactly. There would be coupled equations. So this CA, as we discussed before, this is typically quadratic because if you have just two-body collisions, goes as products of the Fs for the two particles, and then it would sum over all other Fs. So because particle A can collide with all the other particles, itself and other particles. So so the time scale for collisions, if the time is less than the time scale for collisions, the time for whatever you're interested in, or the size of the system is less than the mean free path, then this is called, these are usually the same thing, actually. Then these two, this is called, what is it called? You can guess probably. If either of these is true, is time is less than the collisional time, or length, size of the system is less than the mean free path.
Collisionless.
Collisionless, yes. Collisionless. So this means that there's basically, you can, at least to the first order, you can ignore the collisional effects. And this is opposite, as you remember, this is opposite to the definition of a fluid. So for some processes, collisionless approximation is a good approximation. It turns out, I mean, astrophysics usually, I mean, these, we're going to discuss situations where these get big. But I mean, these are not very, they're not very big and they're not very small. So there are situations, there are some things that are collisionless and some plasmas that are collisionless and some plasmas that are collisional. Or you could say, another way of putting it is there are some processes that are collisionless and some processes that are collisional. And one thing is also this definition is actually dependent on the type of a species that you're talking about. So this TC depends on collision of what and what. Right? And as we're going to discuss,
so you could have a situation where atoms and particles are collisional.
Right, exactly. So usually, and I'm going to discuss in a little bit about how it comes out, usually particles of the same type, their collision happens more effectively or efficiently than the particles that have very different masses or very different types. So usually, let's say TC of AB is much longer than TC of AA, and TC of BB. If MA is much bigger than MB, or the reverse of that, MB is much bigger than MA.
Sorry, is AB, does AB
yeah, so A could be electron and proton, A and B,
different
types of particles, different species of particles, right? So, right. So it could be, right. So TC of, in particular, like TC of electron and proton is much bigger than TC of electron and TC of proton and proton. So you can then say that there are some situations that, so like electrons, electrons can come to thermal equilibrium with each other, protons can come to thermal equilibrium with each other, but electrons don't come to thermal equilibrium with protons because you see, remember the collisions are important to actually reach thermal equilibrium. So you could basically have some things that are in thermal equilibrium and some things that are not in thermal equilibrium. Or some processes that are, that some collisions that are important and some that are not. Okay, so let's actually work out through how these collisions work, and I'm gonna go over this quickly because it's very similar to what we did for am I doing this in the right order? Yes, I think I am, yeah. Okay, so it's going to be very similar to what we did with gravitational collision because it's the same Coulomb force. So the idea would be that you have a charged particle, electron, proton, or ion, and then you have another charged particle that passes by it. And I'm going to be talking in the limit where it's a soft collision or soft scattering, so the scattering angle is small. That's like Q1, this is Q2. So the kick that you get, delta P perpendicular, so this is the P of the particle that's passing by, delta P perpendicular is roughly Q1, Q2 divided by B squared, so this is the electrostatic force, times 2B over V relative. This is the time, basically from here to here, let's say, that the particle spends close to this guy, spends close to this guy. We can do this actually analytically using Gauss's, exactly using Gauss's law, right? I mean, you can imagine, you can just do the integral of the force in the normal direction, and you can correct it to the flux through a cylinder, but I'm not gonna do it here. It's you're gonna get essentially the same thing. With maybe a different numerical factor. So, and then the idea would be that if this is one kick, and then you have to add up all the kicks that you get from subsequent collisions, the subsequent scatterings. So delta P squared of total, delta P total squared would be the delta P normal squared that we got here times the number of scatterings, which is, and assuming that this is basically, so to estimate the time scale of the collision, you want this guy, the original momentum of the particle, to be comparable to the random momentum injected through the lots of scatterings. So this delta P total squared, which is the random walk of the momentum through many subsequent scattering, should be just the P squared that you got from originally from thermal particles. So this is, if it's, that's the case, then you have basically order one effect from a scattering. So individual scatterings give you a small kick, and that's what's guaranteed by the ideal plasma condition, that individual scatterings give you a small kick. And you have lots of kicks, and they add up, by the time that they all add up to something of order of the thermal momentum of a particle, then you have one collision, effectively. That's the definition of a collisional time. And that's basically, so that's Tc times integral 2 pi b dB n v relative times 4 over b squared q to the fourth v relative squared. So assuming they have the same charges here, so this is just squaring this guy here, and then this guy is just the number of collisions per unit time, and this is multiplied by time is just the total number of collisions, right? This is area times flux of particles. This is the total flux, total number per unit time, and multiplying by time is just the total number. That's what I want. And here you remember there is this cancellation, so you have, there is this logarithmic divergence, which was the Coulomb logarithm. And V relative, there also cancellation here. So what you get is something like 8 pi n q to the fourth divided by V relative Tc log B max by B mean. This is what we usually call, I think we called this log lambda before. This is called Coulomb logarithm. Okay. So here's the key thing here. What am I missing? Am I missing something? Okay, so let's see. If I want to do this correctly, I mean, I guess I want, these are particles A and B. Let me just call this QA, QB, QA, QB. There is V relative here. Again, this QA squared, QB squared. And so let's say this particle is the one that's passing by is, I guess the one that passing by here in this picture is, yeah, I think this should be, there must be a reduced mass somewhere here, which I guess I don't need it, do I? But let's do this. This is particle. This A could be electron, for example. So this is P. These are all for particle A.
Shouldn't there be a mass and momentum?
Sorry, what is that?
Shouldn't there be a mass and
momentum? No, because force times time is just change in momentum, right? So this is just change for particle A. And so this is the time for time scale for collision of particle A with particle B. So this would be QA squared, QB squared, and TCAB. And then there's the V relative of A and B. OK? Good. So, so what we get is for the time scale is, TCAB collisional time for particles A and B is this number, and it would be P thermal of particle A squared right times V relative of A and B divided by 8 pi n number density QA squared, QB squared, and then there's a log of B max divided by B min. Okay, so this log of this B max and B min, they're not terribly important. This log is somewhere between 10 to 20, as it turns out, because I mean, no matter how big or small number is, this log never gets very big or very small. So this number, of course, by definition is bigger than one, so the log is always positive, but I mean, never gets very big. And in practice, so the appropriate B max and B min, so what do you think is the appropriate B max for this type of a scattering? Right, it's a divided length. Because here we're using electrostatic force. As we discussed, electrostatic force is shielded beyond the divided length. So that's the maximum distance for which you can use this. So what will be the minimum? So what would be the minimum be the impact parameter for which this breaks down? Radius of? What is the radius? What is the radius of proton?
Two times.
Okay, but I mean, what is the radius of a proton? So what breaks down in this, what I've done here, if big gets a small? What electric? But why do I have to overcome? I mean, I'm not making a bound.
Or the closest you can get is to back that up. Your energy is less than your potential, you can't get any closer. So I would imagine that's the smallest.
Yeah, I don't know what that means. So the energy is always positive. Okay, so let me try to rephrase your answer to be the right to the right. So what I assume here was a small angle of scattering. So I assume it's moving on a straight line. Of course, if it gets very close, it wouldn't move on a straight line, right? Because it would be either repulsion or attraction. Either of them would bend it. Okay, so there's a minimum radius coming for just from when kinetic energy becomes comparable to the potential energy, which is E squared divided by mu, V relative squared. So mu is the reduced mass. Yeah, I can write it here. Mu is just mu inverse is MA inverse plus MB inverse. But of course, this is classical. There is also a quantum mechanical effect, which is which says that there is a minimum angular momentum. Right? So this calculation is classical, but of course, at some point, quantum mechanics become important. And so what is the minimum angular momentum? Anybody know? H bar, 1, I guess. If H bar is 1, then that's 1. Good. So the point is, so MA times B is the MA times VA times B. I guess MA, angular momentum is MA times V relative times B. And this should be bigger than H bar, basically. If it becomes less than H bar, then the classical calculation breaks down. So that's that puts also a lower limit on B. And the maximum of whichever these guys is, that gives you the B min. And if you actually know, this is similar to what we had for Bremerstrahlung radiation, if you remember. So this essentially there was the same process we were looking at for Bremerstrahlung radiation. So the Bmax is, and we had the same logarithm. I guess it was called Gaunt factor, or related to the Gaunt factor. And there was the same way of setting the maximum and minimum, which is either due to the harder scattering or the quantum effects, which is h bar divided by mu v, what is it? Mu vb, v relative, let's say. Okay. So, but I mean, as I said, the details don't matter so much. This is some number that's order of 10 to 20. And so the time scale. So let's see whether I can do this correctly. I haven't written the general formula for A and B. I think I've written it for kind of, I broke it up into different cases. But the point is that for thermal electrons or thermal particles, you know what P squared is? P thermal squared is what? What is P thermal? What is the momentum of a thermal particle? KT? So the momentum is? So P squared divided by mass is energy. So this would be KT times mass, right? And V relative is, right. So the V relative depends on, good. So you have two thermal velocities, right? So we have thermal velocity of electrons and protons, for example. Well, right. So, but of course, if they are uncorrelated, so V relative is VA minus VB, but these are uncorrelated. So V relative squared would be VA squared plus VB squared plus the cross term, which on average vanishes because A and B are randomly oriented in thermal distribution. So this would be KT times 1 over MA plus 1 over MB, right? So that's the formula for V relative, right? So now you see how this thing works out, right? So this is the general formula, but then there's this factors that depend on mass. So in particular, you have this guy squared, and then you have this V relative. So this is proportional to, if you're just interested in the mass dependencies, there would be MA times V relative, which is a square root of this guy. 1 over MA, 1 over MB, right? So for example, so now I can write it down for, so there is of course some factors that depend on temperature and other things. You can plug in and calculate those. But the important point I wanted to make was basically the dependence on these masses, that TC, for example, for ions, this would be proportional to the mass of ion. If you are just collisions of ions with ions, this is MI, and this is one over square root of MI. So this would be just a square root of MI. For ions and electrons, this would be, if you want ions to collide with electrons, that would be MI that sits here. But electron has a smaller mass than ion, so this would be 1 over ME that matters here. 1 over square root of ME. And then for TC of electron-electron, then, right, this would be just M electron, so it would be a square root of M electron. One thing I didn't write, but you could also imagine, there is TC of electron ion, right? So So that would be m of electron, and then it would be, again, mass of electron that matters here. So this would be just a square root of m electron. So, and of course, m of ion is basically if you have the atomic number, what is it called? They call it A, right? So it's A times like 2 times 10 to the 3 times m electron, right? Mass of ion, mass of a proton is 2,000 mass of electron, is that right? I mean, yeah, it's 2,000. Right? And like if you have atomic numbers, depend. So this is a huge number. This is much bigger than mass of electron. So if you're...
Why would the collision rate between an ion and an electron be different than between
good.
An electron?
Right. So because you're talking about two different things. Right. So it's the same collisions, but you're asking how long does it take for these collisions to affect momentum of an electron, how long does it take for collisions to affect momentum of an ion, right? So it's like if you have like a bunch of bugs and then somebody's like, there's a dinosaur moving among them, right? So the dinosaurs, the bugs barely affect the dinosaur, but then obviously dinosaur affects the bugs, right? So those are two different questions, right? And I guess the way I've written it.
So this isn't like a collision rate. This is more like a rate of momentum change.
So this is the time at that it takes for collisions to have a significant effect,
okay.
Right? So it's the same. Like when you think about the bug scattering off a dinosaur, they exchange the same momentum, but dinosaur has much bigger momentum than the bug, right? So it takes much longer to affect the dinosaur than it takes to affect the mosquito, let's say. I don't know if mosquitoes existed when dinosaurs existed. So that's an interesting. So I don't know how relevant an analogy that is. So the interesting, I mean, if you just look at, you want to compare the ratios, of course, these are all dimensionful. But in terms of ratios, if you just say want to compare TCEE and TCIE and then TCEE. Then, so the electron is the one that's most efficient. If you say that's one, then ion electron, so you just divide this by this, then it would be bigger by this factor of a square root of mi by me. Sorry, this was ii. The last one was, am I screwing this thing? I hope I'm not screwing it. So ii, ie, the last one is ee. Right, okay. So if EE is 1, then IE, so I just divide everything by square root of ME. IE would be MI divided by ME, right? And, okay. And II, so the last one is II, it just would be a square root of MI divided by ME. So, I'm just here, they're just comparing the ratios. So the fastest one, with the shortest time, is the electron-electron scattering, right? The electrons reach thermal equilibrium amongst themselves, collide amongst themselves fastest than anything else. The slowest one would be ions and electrons reaching thermal equilibrium. They don't. I'm just comparing the ratios here, right?
Oh, yeah.
So you see the ion doesn't depend here. But I'm saying if this is one, then this is how much bigger or smaller they are. So, and this is the same thing I was saying, that the equilibrium between unequal masses is the slowest. Of course, big guys, as we were discussing, they also take longer to interact with each other, right? But this is not quite as big as this one. So these guys first reach equilibrium, then ions reach equilibrium amongst themselves, and the last ions and electrons reach equilibrium with each other, right?
And electron ion will reach about the same time as electron ion.
No, this is much longer.
Yeah.
No, the other way.
Oh. Okay. So. Right. So. EI. Yeah, I think this formula, it's a little bit buggy. But this last one, I think I was, the way I was writing this down, Right, so the time it takes...
faster than electron-electron because the momentum of the ion is
right
affecting the electron way more?
No, so the problem here is that, so this is the time it takes for the electron momentum to be randomized, right? Mm-hmm. So if you think that the particle electrons are moving along and is scattering off ions, but of course, that doesn't tell you about energy exchange. It just tells you how long it takes to randomize energy. So I shouldn't write. So this formula, if I wrote it more carefully, there would be some reduced masses that come in. And I think this actually turns out to be the same as this one. Yeah, I shouldn't have written this one, actually. And the reason for that, I think the physical ground, you know, because, I mean, if one comes to equilibrium with the other, so this, I mean, the same happens at the same time, right? But then heuristically, there was something that was basically not quite right about it. Because I calculated the rate at which the momentum changes, but then I really want to calculate the rate at which the energy changes. And if you have a heavy ion, the momentum of electron changes significantly, but its energy actually doesn't change, right? It just scatters off with maybe a large angle, but it has the same energy. So it's kind of similar to this Compton scattering versus Thompson scattering that we were discussing before. It's the fact that ion is not infinite mass, it has a finite mass. So it's the same mechanism, it's just, right. The mechanism is the same, it's just not this formula. Because this formula is the momentum transfer, but if you're interested in the energy transfer, not the momentum transfer, then you have to, there would be basically a 1/mass suppression if this guy is heavy. Right. So I haven't written this carefully enough, but it's just straightforward enough for you guys to work that out.
It's like in the lecture with Avery, we discussed what the quantity conserved when you have a pendulum on a table and you pull it out.
Mm-hmm.
So the conserved quantity is E over omega and not just E.
Mm-hmm. And the same right. I mean, this is, I don't think, it, I mean, I mean, I guess maybe there could be a relationship between that. Yeah. But I mean, I think it's just this calculation was a bit too naive. I have to be a little bit more careful, keep the reduced masses in the right places. So, but yeah, I think this turns out to be the same as this guy. You can verify that. Okay, let's see. Show TCIE is the same as TC. Okay. Do this as an exercise. Good. And in practice, if you want to figure out what the number is, and I think I'm, yeah, good. Okay, at least I'm, now I'm at the end of the lecture I was supposed to give last time, so at least I'm not too far behind. So TC for EE, if you plug in the numbers in these formulas that we had, then you get something like 30 years. Divided by this L, I guess what they call log lambda, divided by 10, let's say. So if you assume log lambda is 10, then this would be 30 years. But the temperature dependence is T^3/2 in keV units. And number density would be a square per cubic centimeter. So this would be in CGH units. But it's a little bit funny units, but this is the temperature you expect for a plasma, or like hot plasma in clusters of galaxies. So this would be keV in solar core. You expect keV is 10 to the 7 Kelvin. So this could be either a cluster of galaxy or the center of the virial temperature of the sun, for example. Or it could be the corona of the sun, actually. That also works out. The number density is, of course, in the sun is much bigger. In the cluster of galaxies, the number density is of this order, of 1 per cubic centimeter. So this is short, of course, by astrophysical timescales. But then the ion electron, it turns out, it's bigger by this factor. So it's 2 × 10³. 2,000 times, I guess, A divided by Z squared times TC of EE. And so let's see. So the idea is that, for example, if you have a cosmological plasma, then this could come of order of the Hubble time.
Should it be a squared or just a?
I think it's a. It's just because it's the mass, right? This mi is just a times 2,000.
Okay. So then, what's the z squared?
So z squared is this, right?
Okay.
So if you have electron of an ion, Z is the, what is it called, atomic number of the ion. Mm-hmm. Right, so for example, for cosmological densities, N is of order 1 per cubic meter. So that would be, smaller by 10 to the 6. So that gives you 3 times 10 to the 4 years. And then another 10 to the 3 here. I keep thinking, missing something. 10 to the 4th under 3 is 2 times 10 to the 7 years. That's still, I think it's still longer than this. I think it becomes comparable to the Hubble time, which is 10 to the 10 years. So I'm not 100% sure what I'm missing here, but I guess if it's, you have 10 keV and number densities are small, then probably you can get there. But yeah, I think my recollection is on cosmological scales, and high temperatures, T of order 10 keV, then what you get is, I think TC of ions and electrons becomes comparable to Hubble time, to H inverse. So in fact, on cosmological scales, ion temperature and electron temperature don't have to be the same. Or they could be offset by some 20-30% difference.
So would that be for like plasmas and galaxy clusters?
Right. The plasmas in the outskirts of galaxy clusters where n gets small, this would be the case. Right. I think I'm missing some factors, but they're basically, I think it becomes roughly of order Hubble time. Okay, good. So that's, and another place this also is important is in accretion disks, like at the center of the galaxy. That's another place where it turns out that this is not very long, but it's the cooling is much faster, cooling to Bremerstrahlung. So electrons happen to be much colder than ions because the cooling is, so let's see, can I do this? Does this actually make sense when I think about it? Right. So for Bremerstrahlung cooling, if you remember, I kind of wrote down the formula yesterday. The Bremerstrahlung goes as something like T to the 1/2, the time scale is T to the 1/2 divided by the number density. So at large number density, or is proportional to this. Large temperature, this gets large. So, okay, good, so this makes sense. If you go to very large temperatures, then this gets very long. Because this goes as this, both of these are scaling like T to the 3/2. So very large temperatures, you expect relativistic temperatures close to black holes of order GeV, for example. So then what happens is that both of these grow, but this grows much faster. So the time scale for cooling due to Bremerstrahlung becomes larger than the time scale to reach thermal equilibrium with ions. So electrons basically lose energy, become much colder, because of course electrons do much more Bremerstrahlung than ions. Remember, we discussed that. So that's what you get. Okay. And I guess another thing I said before, Larbo radius is also another. If you do have magnetic fields, then Larmor radius is tiny. Of order of meter or so. So it's the everything just goes around magnetic field in all almost all astrophysical situations, except for very, very high energy cosmic rays. What you have is charged particles are just following magnetic fields. Okay. So good. Any questions so far? Nope. Everything is very clear. So let's see. I had some somewhat detailed calculations. I suppose I have to get it started, otherwise I'm never gonna finish it. And then we're going to pick it up next time. So what I wanted to do next is to show you or give you a flavor of how perturbation theory or linear waves propagate in plasmas. And these would be collisionless plasmas. So this would be either processes, waves that have wavelength or periods, let's say much shorter than this time scale. So you can ignore collisional effects. And you just solve these equations. So there is this equation for electron. Right, what we wrote before, the charge is negative, E plus V cross B. And in CGS units, just remember E and B have the same dimension. There's V over C that appears here. And I'm ignoring gravity. And then there's the same thing for ions. So for ion, they have a Z, which is atomic number, times E. Of course, the sign is different. And then there's E plus V cross B over C dot partial FP, or FI by P equals 0. And I guess in principle, you could have more than one ion. And then, so one thing to notice, so this equation is linear. So remember, these are functions of x, are functions of x and p. So these terms are linear. This is a term that's nonlinear, because E and B depend on f itself, right? And the way they depend is, I guess, through Maxwell equations, right? Curl of E is minus 1 over C dB by dt. Curl of B is 1 over C dE by dt. I'm not going to write down the vector sign because, yeah, these are already very long. You also have dB equal to 0. You have dE equal to 4 pi rho. And of course, rho and these are charge density and current density. So rho is defined as E times integral d3p. P Z Fi minus F E. And J is defined as E integral d3p. There's a V here and Z Fi minus F E. So this is collisionless plasma physics. This is what I've written here on the board is collisionless plasma physics. And here, note that so the dynamical degrees of freedom, so they have a six-dimensional degree of freedom, which depends on time, f of x and p. And you have two three-dimensional degrees of freedom, e of x and t and b of x and t. So these guys are, these are dynamical equations. I guess you could say this gives you dB by dt and dE by dt. These are, so the time derivative, so you can put this on a computer, right? You have initial conditions for E, B, and F, then you can put these four equations on a computer, and they tell you how FA, phase space density of electron, for any P and X, phase space density of ions, magnetic field and electric field is evolved with time. These equations are constraints. You don't actually need to use them on a computer. The idea is that they have to be satisfied in your initial conditions. And if they're satisfied in your initial conditions, they will remain satisfied through this evolution equations. So this is there are two types of equations. And for those of you who are going to do general relativity at some point in your future, it's the same thing with general relativity. You have dynamical equations for general relativity, and you have constraint equations. The constraint equations, you don't actually need them. At least in principle, you don't actually need them to evolve the system. You actually need the dynamical equations, but the constraints need to be satisfied initially. And if they're satisfied initially, they have to be satisfied. Because numerically, there might be problems that your constraints may be satisfied initially, but your numerical integration scheme may break that down. So that's one of the challenges in all this that you have to, in the so-called gauge theories, you have to make sure the constraints are satisfied. And general relativity, this was a decades-long struggle. People came up with a way to make this satisfied or keep them satisfied. In electromagnetism, these are linear equations, so everything is straightforward. It's not as big of a problem. This is charge density. This is current density. This is a relativistic limit. And essentially, almost everything in plasma physics that you're interested in basically can be derived from these equations, except that these are very complicated equations, as you can imagine. Good. Any questions? So some things can be done easily. For example, linear perturbations around a homogeneous background is essentially, in most cases, can be done trivially. Right. And for linear perturbations, the easiest thing is to go into the Fourier space. If you have a homogeneous uniform medium, homogeneous and time-independent medium, so all the time derivatives become I omega, or the spatial derivatives become ik, there are still derivatives, the momentum that are left. And that's maybe different from what you might be used to, because the distribution in position might be uniform, the background distribution, but distribution in momentum is never uniform, because you have a finite density of particles, there must be a maximum momentum, right? Beyond which you don't have particles. So the temperature basically tells you, so for the background, F bar of P would be something like e to the minus P squared, or proportion, well, actually it's equal to e to the minus P squared over 2m. MT, or yes, MKT. So this would be the Boltzmann distribution. So linear perturbations are perturbations around this. And you can assume E and B are zero if you don't have a magnetized or electric, and if you don't have a background electric and magnetic field. But then this would always have this. In the simplest case, it should have this structure.
Term over KT?
That's right. P squared, no, this is like e to the minus e over KT. Right, okay. So the way you could deal with all these is that all the variables, you could, let's say, for example, E, you could write it integral of E hat, e to the I, k dot x. So this e hat is a function of k and omega. So this was a function of x and t. E hat of k of omega, k dot x minus omega t. D3 k, and am I doing this right? D3 k d omega. Right. This is. So so you go to the Fourier space, and it's OK, because if your background doesn't have x dependent and t dependent, you can show, this is basically basics of Fourier transform, that different k and omegas don't talk to each other. They decouple from each other. Right. Okay? Because if you just plug in there, all the derivatives d by dt's and d by dx's gives you omega and k's, and you just get one equation for any k and omega, you get one equation. Now, what's different is that you have an integral equation because there is an integral here over d3p. So it's not an algebraic equation. It's an integral equation. Let's see. And I guess one last thing I want to say is there is also, in terms of definition, there is a so-called polarization vector. And this is something you've all seen in undergraduate electromagnetism, where you define this induction, which is E plus 4 pi p. This is not to be confused by momentum. And then this is essentially, this is the definition is this. Partial definition of induction is just dp by dt is j, and divergence of p is minus rho. So this is just the displacement of the charges. And it can get big, the displacement can be big, but for neutral plasmas, the charges, never get, for a linear perturbation, this can never get big. So if J is a current, so essentially J was integral d3p x, p is just the same thing times the displacement of the charge. So the velocity you have, displacement, if you can imagine what that means, you just imagine how far the charges move from its original position. That would be displacement. The time derivative of that gives you current, and divergence of that gives you charge density. Right. Good. So that's the definition. And if you remember, we defined permittivity. The I is epsilon ij times E, ej. And for regular media, this is a constant. So that would be epsilon for the medium. Turns out for plasmas, in fact, there are two different. Okay, so the thing that you probably are familiar with this epsilon in the static limit, the epsilon is a constant. However, in this dynamical limit, this can depend on k and omega in principle, right? Omega and k. This depends on omega and k. Depends on omega and k. And in fact, it turns out that then you could have an epsilon, longitudinal epsilon, and transverse epsilon compared to the direction of k. So epsilon ij, you could define an epsilon transverse, which is, I had it somewhere, delta ij minus ki kj divided by k squared. Plus epsilon L Kij divided by K squared. So this is along the K. So this is just saying that if you're thinking about electric field that's along the wave vector, so this will be longitudinal mode. So the basic electrons and protons are moving just in the same direction that the plane wave is moving, like sound waves, for example. Then you see this epsilon matters, but then for transverse ones like light, for example, for photons, the electric field is perpendicular to the direction of propagation, right? So that's why photons are transverse. So these don't have to be the same. There's nothing that tells you these should be different. In the case of in the static field, this doesn't make sense because k goes to zero, so you just have one vector, right? You don't have, basically, sorry, we have one number. You cannot make two independent tensors. Here you have two independent tensors, delta ij. So epsilon ij is a tensor, a 3x3 tensor. And in general, it should be either a function of delta proportional to delta ij or ki kj. But if you, in a static case, you have just delta ij. That's why when you did electrostatics as an undergrad, you had one epsilon. Here there are two of them for dynamical waves, right? And see. Oh, good God. Right. And the other thing is, so we can just write down equations, and I probably won't be able to solve them for you. Yeah, it's not going to do it. To try to just have a mental photograph of this, because, yeah, we're going to have to stop at some point. Okay, so we're doing linear perturbations. I said this is the background, F bar. Electric field vanishes in the background. Magnetic field vanishes in the background. So your background is no electric or magnetic field. And that's the F bar at your start. So this is an assumption, a simplifying assumption. So if you have a background in which there is no electric field and no magnetic field, then the calculations I'm going to write down is going to follow.
But we can't assume that they're there, but it's just going to be more complicated.
Yes, it's going to be more complicated. Right. So you're going to get more waves. So I'm going to get some certain types of waves. If you assume this, and I'm going to talk about that later, I guess maybe next week, I think. If you do assume there's magnetic field, then it's going to get more complicated. For example, you can get a BI, BJ term here as well. So there will be three types of permittivity. Right?
So this is assuming all the electric and magnetic fields come from the particles and not something else?
Well, it doesn't really matter for this purpose, right? I mean, all I care is about if these equations are valid. Right. If electric field, that being zero, that's kind of saying that you have a conductive medium, right? If you have conduction, and in fact, I mean, this plasma's conduction is very high, electric field decays very, very quickly. Magnetic field, now that's being zero, that's an assumption. And as I said, that's not always a good assumption. For example, there is a Larmor radius is very small for, as we discussed, for thermal particles. So for some calculations, then that's not good. So you have to include. It turns out that for photons, for short wavelength perturbations, basically, if lambda, the wavelength of your linear perturbations, is much less than the Larmor radius, then it makes sense. You can ignore it, right? But then if it becomes bigger, then obviously you care about magnetic field, because you can only move along magnetic field. You cannot move across magnetic field. So here I'm assuming basically this is the case. So the equations actually become very simple. So this magnetic term doesn't matter anymore if I'm interested in linearized perturbation, because is it obvious why it doesn't matter? Why doesn't it matter? There's a good reason for this. Oh, yeah. OK, no, I know. So the reason is that df by dp is proportional to p, right? Because it's radially symmetric in the p space. But then perpendicular to, this term is perpendicular to v. And V and P are, of course, are parallel. Momentum and velocity of electron are parallel to each other. So this term is always 0 to, right? This term is always 0. At least for the background. To linear order, so the magnetic field, if it's not there in the background, it would be only generated due to perturbations. So this would be already first order. So this guy, I should put it to 0th order, right? But of course, to 0th order, this is 0 because it's V cross B, and this is proportional to V. So this term should vanish. Right. So the equations that I'll be solving are these equations, d by dt of delta F plus V dot d delta F by dx equals E dot partial F naught. Or F bar, I guess that's what I call it, by partial P. This is for electrons, of course. And as I said, D by DT you put it as I minus I omega gradient. It's IK. If you go to the Fourier space. And then the interesting thing is that you get this equation becomes an algebraic equation, right? Because these are all, you just plug in for all of that. And then you get delta F hat in the Fourier space, that is, the function of P, omega, and K is E electric field. This is also a hat, I should say, I guess hat, omega, and K. Divided by I k dot v minus omega dot partial f now f bar by partial p. This is just a function of p. This is the thermal thing, for example, that I wrote there. I guess it doesn't have to be thermal. It could be anything. Right. Thermal, of course, is the most natural choice. So this is a solution to the Boltzmann equation, right? However, there is some subtlety here that you don't actually know what this E hat is. But other than that, you have all the frequency and K dependences here. Well, sorry, you have the momentum dependence here. The omega and K dependence, you have to know what this guy is. And that, you have to get it from where? Where do you get E hat from? Anybody guess? From what?
Charge density.
Charge density, right. What did you say?
Constraint equation.
Right, constraint equation, the charge density, dipole thing, the Gauss's law, basically, right? So tells you that basically IK dot E hat divided by 4 pi is the perturbation in the charge density, which is minus E integral of delta F D3P. So that's the one that's not as easy to solve. But we're going to solve it next time. So next time, we're going to try to solve all this. An interesting thing you'll notice is there is a place where this goes to 0. And that basically, naively, that means that this delta F hat goes to infinity. And that's related to Landau, so-called Landau damping. So that's where this thing goes to 0. And we're going to talk about that in more detail next time. So we can solve this. And basically, but this is the combination. These two equations are the ones that you have to solve.
Damming or damping?
OK, it could be damming as well. It's damping, right? Damping. It's where this thing goes to 0. OK. Good. So let's. Okay, I think since I have to run now to the colloquium on the other side, this is a good time to break. And it's about entanglement stuff. Yeah, sure. You're in charge of your own time, so let me
just for the 7:89.
Right, right. That's okay. No, I think you just.
I have a meeting with Manchester.
Right. That's okay. Sure. Yeah, I think I'm just trying to get the title.
Entanglement tensor or something.
Entanglement tensor, right. Funny, I don't get to see it here. Many-body entanglement and tensor network states. An overview. Okay.